What's up? You're listening to Soft Difference, a podcast of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. On this pod, you'll hear from Giorgio, Eric, and myself, Justin, talk about 1 Peter and how 1 Peter calls us to love Jesus and love others in the world. Welcome back, everybody. It's Justin here with my co-host.
Giorgio, right here.
Welcome back, everybody. We're glad you're listening.
All right, so the main experience I had of the sermon to start was the whole week before, knowing I've preached this passage before, and all the ways it's been misunderstood, mm-hmm. and all the ways it's been, you know, all the beauty in it that you're trying to get out. Mm-hmm. And so we talk decently awesome about your preparation of heart and reading, and so talk a little bit about that, because you did bring, I mean, the passage is about the S word, submission, mm-hmm. So yeah, tell us how you oriented this last week.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much in our moment, in our denomination, that this text like dances around anyway, and my lovely daughter for her wedding was gave Matt commands when he did his homily not to mention the S word. I think it's so loaded,
right?
And has been so misused, you know, even by me and by most Christian men in their marriages. I think it's been mistaught. So man, it was on, you know, I had 2 weeks too.
Yeah, that's right.
So, knew it was coming, and you know, I'm still relatively new to Redeemer. And so the context is, I'm still learning the context. So I want to be able to be, faithful to the text, but also really understanding of the people that I'm preaching to. And so it was, you know, in my thoughts for 2 weeks. What was different about this is that I asked a lot of different women,
right,
about this text, you know, Redeemer women, other women. I wanted to get feedback from my daughter, so I wanted to get, Danette was like, why didn't you ask me for feedback? And I was like, well, baby, you know, this isn't necessarily something that you like to dialogue about. So I didn't want to like cause you any anxiety and having like to cause you to have to think, not think, but to discuss that if you were, it's not something you normally want to do. But we laughed about that. But yeah, like I wanted to know how this text hits when some of these ladies hear it.
Right.
I wanted to know what their thoughts were, you know, and I had really rich dialogue with some different ladies about that. And of course, you know, Karen Jobes is, you know, one of the primary commentators, you know, both G and I and Eric are using as we walk through this. And, you know, she's excellent as an exegete.
She's renowned in this book in particular. She's amazing.
It was interesting to talk to Susan about her, that, you know, Susan knows Karen and has talked with her, and she encouraged me and with Karen's, just her writing. But I wanted those voices.
Right.
And they were very important. I think as, you know, you sit with this, it's like you want to be faithful to the text.
Yep.
And faithful to the people you're preaching to. So that was really what was on my mind.
Right. And so different, a little different in terms of how you started the sermon. You did a lot of like prep work for us to hear, mm-hmm. both in the practice, the spiritual practice of kind of gratitude towards God, mm-hmm. and humility to receive it, mm-hmm. receive the word before the reading. You do that almost every time, but you did it in a more significant way. Mm-hmm. And then you spent a lot of time like owning and orienting towards the fact that this might hit you wrong. And I just, that's just a fact. And I know you were doing it out of a pastoral heart, so mm-hmm. that we could enter into your own struggle and wrestling and trying to be faithful to the text and to love it while also knowing there's a lot wrong in the world. So mm-hmm. I was very thankful for that. So why didn't you do the men yet, the husbands?
Yeah, so that's a, you know,
this is like, I'm asking this because you guys don't know the kind of decisions we have to make, even though we have a plan, that there are times in the week you're like, that's going to be too much to bite off or something like that. So, yeah.
So some of the ladies that I reached out to give me some feedback on this text, like, didn't respond to me till like Saturday night. And, of course I write on Sundays for the most part. Like, this is a sermon I preached in 2014, but it's quite a bit different than when I preached it then, for a lot of different reasons. G was in the first service when this happened, but I got to the 28-ish minute mark in the first service, and I was done with verses 1-6, and I still had verse 7, and I was like, well, this is a 45-minute sermon now, and we don't have that in the first service. So that was one reason why it was cut. The main reason it was cut was one of the feedback I got from one of the women is that she said, man, it seems like when we talk about these texts, we spend the majority of the time talking to or about women, and we don't spend equal amounts of time talking about the men.
Oh.
And that was in my ear at 28 minutes.
Right.
And I was like, and I wrestled with it with the congregation. I actually just stopped and said, okay, we're at such and such, and I still have this whole thing to go. And I think I'm going to end it right now.
Right.
And because of that voice in my head, I did not want to communicate this whole text where I was trying to intricately speak to the women in our congregation and then rush through.
Right, right. And then the add-on is, hey, dudes, you have to do this too. Right, right. You don't want that.
And not be adequate. And then just kind of exacerbate the very thing that, you know, has been done by us in our preaching, which we have to own.
Right.
Even though it might not be my own personal thing, it is our thing.
Yeah. As a company of preachers. Yeah. Right, right, right.
So I decided that, well, we're just going to change up the way we do it. And I would like to say, yeah, I had this planned, but I didn't.
You didn't. You didn't know it was going to take 20 minutes on the first part, which I think it required that. So it's okay.
Yeah.
The great thing about it is that, you know, next week's sermon's a third of the way done. So that's always, that's also really nice. Yeah, just when you do split them up, that's pretty great when you do that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go through some salient points that I heard. And then I'm going to like you interspersed application and how this all works the whole time. So I'm dividing those up. I'm not going linearly through the sermon, but, you talked, you were very confessional to the community of preachers and men of the misuse of this text. Mm-hmm. Were there either examples or teachings you've heard that were in your head as you were talking about that? Mm-hmm. Or we both agree generally that's true, but but how has that been? How did you made a pretty decent emphasis of that, and so I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so as I worked through this, and Karen Jobs was super helpful for me in this, but also just the voices of these different ladies, that what Peter is, there's a context for this for Peter. So first, just the Greco-Roman context and what that meant and how Peter's subverting that from the inside, but also just that this is, he's writing, at least we could even maybe debate both to women and men here, which maybe I will a little bit on this Sunday, but to unbelieving spouses.
Right.
So to do justice to that reality. Now, Paul, of course, expands it, and it's for believing and unbelieving in some sense of the word.
Right.
And I think it can apply in both contexts, but that's an important thing to say. This is not just a marriage text.
Right.
Oftentimes it's pulled out in a marriage series as a marriage text.
Like trying to mirror it with Paul in some way, which there's overlap, but it's not the same context.
And so in Peter's argument, he is, using, he's talking about our relationship to the outsider, to the non-Christian, to the Gentile in his case, that does not believe that we're to do good to win Gentiles to Jesus, like to do good to them, to honor them. And then he walks through servants and masters, and that's why
then a husbands, servant.
And then, now he works through husbands and wives as part of the household code. And so, like, it's important to do justice to that those realities.
Right.
Where I think in the past, like, this has been pulled out of that context. And so...
And used in a way that was harmful to women.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Job's, I think, even, like, expounds on this even better with the imperatival participle.
Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being English majors, I was like, that boy just said imperatival participle in a sermon.
Yeah,
and
bro.
It made it a main point.
I'm not really comfortable doing that. My Greek is not great. I was terrible at Greek. But also just, like... I don't love that form of preaching where you're like really diving through individual words. And
right.
You sometimes can lose the forest for the trees in that. But I thought it was really important. And then also, like, I think what Job says, which I thought was super helpful, is that to remember that submission is always a voluntary act.
That's right.
That's done by the woman in this case, that she voluntarily does this. It's not demanded. Which is helpful for the misuse of this, because oftentimes it's demanded.
Right.
Act
of coercion versus invitation.
You're supposed to submit to me. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's a voluntary act by the woman. And she's doing it not because of necessarily her trust of her husband, although I think that does alleviate some of the tension here. If there is great trust, it's in her trust of God. And then, like, he leaves it open. He does not tease this out. He does not give us
the particular things you should do.
Right? Like, I gave some examples of what might be in context to Paul, not even in our context, but in context to Paul, or to Peter, sorry, what he might be thinking about here, possibly. But he doesn't tell us that. It's to be worked out between the husband and the wife. And I thought that was very, like, freeing in a sense of, like, a husband and wife should be working out how this looks in each individual marriage with each individual decision. So that was helpful, like, because I think the misuse of this is that that's not how it is. It's just,
here's the clear role.
Yeah.
Here's what you're supposed to do. Right. Here's what you're not supposed to do.
Imperatival participle is important to that. It is providing this, like, tone of what he's saying, where if the Roman code would be direct command or direct imperative, an imperatival participle is a more gentler voice.
And so the translation isn't wives submit to your unbelieving husbands. It's submitting to your husbands.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a different, doesn't mean there's not a grammatical command in there.
Right.
Grammatically, it's still a command.
Right.
But it is not as stark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's addressed to women, which I thought was huge for you, because mm-hmm. all household codes were addressed to the paterfamilias mm-hmm. alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is that usurping, that this depth charge, or you said something about concrete, like it cracks the concrete from the bottom.
Yeah, it's a seed planted under concrete.
Concrete.
Burst up. You know, you got... We're here in the South, and you guys know how, like, that happens. Like, you see concrete getting broken up. Like, if you walk, I mean, we did this in New Orleans. Like, you walk the sidewalks of New Orleans, and, like, every sidewalk is, like, you know, jutted.
Yeah, there's some root somewhere.
These oak trees that are splitting the concrete, and that's really what this is.
Yeah.
It's like, it's splitting the concrete of patriarchy and paterfamilias, and the code of Rome and the empire from underneath.
And I'm just going to add to this is that, like, back when Ben preached a couple weeks ago, he recommended a book called Dominion, and the dork that I am got this 600-page book and started reading it. And one of the things that I kind of knew, but he fleshes out in such significant ways, is that the code of Rome was not... It allowed for people to do different things, even worship other gods, but there was no way to break it.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't trying. You never did something ostensibly
mm-hmm.
to break the code.
That's good.
And that trickled down. I think he used the language of the paterfamilias, the head of the household, was the empire mm-hmm. or the emperor mm-hmm. of his empire, mm-hmm. and everything served that.
Mm-hmm.
And the magic and beauty of this passage is you can work with that system.
Yep.
You can do that. And yep. and then you do it in a very different way
yep.
than being fearful.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you use language like defiant loyalty, you use submission as a revolutionary. So talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think like I built this sermon around verse 6 and where, you know, he uses Sarah as a example of not fearing what is frightening. I did not want to take away the realities of what it feels like to submit. I started with the airline, travel kind of example. I try to start with that purposely. It's not loaded. Like, everybody can understand this. Like, we've all been in places where we don't have control, and we have to submit to that, and that's a scary place to, like, live.
Absolutely.
When I fly, like, you know, I used to be much more anxious about flying than I am now. But there is a lot of prayer that I would do.
Oh, yeah.
In the sense of like submitting myself to God and his control. I'm not one that necessarily likes being out of control all the time, especially in that sense. I like to be the one that's driving the car.
Right.
Like to feel like I have some level. We can go here. Enneagram 7 stuff. When you're in plane, you're like, you're locked in, bro, and you ain't got no control.
you're in a torpedo with wings.
That's a fearful place to be no matter who we are as human beings, mm-hmm. right? And it's especially fearful when Peter says this to women. Like, it's a fearful place to be. And yet, like, it can be, if done voluntarily, mm-hmm. with deep trust and trusting yourself to the Lord like Jesus does, mm-hmm. it can be this defiant act. It can be this, you said subversion. What did you say?
Submission is revolutionary, yeah. Defiant loyalty. I'm still in the game. Yeah. I'm willing to honor you where I can.
Yep.
But I still might go to church, mm-hmm. and
right.
people going to talk.
Yeah, that's right.
And obviously, there are some who have chosen to do that because yep. he's literally writing to them.
Correct.
Even before the husbands, even before the paterfamilias.
Right.
And so, obviously, there are a lot of women who made this decision yep. at great jeopardy to themselves
yep.
in terms of what could happen. So, they're already a courageous lot, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? But you also were like, well, you know, if you skip a Sunday, we ain't going to be mad at you. You know, mm-hmm. if there's a reason you needed to do that, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, that's the kind of defiant and the submission. It's got a sneaky way of being.
Yeah, and that in itself is scary. So it's like how can we not fear the frightening? It's only by entrusting ourselves to Jesus, and that is the wrestling that has to happen internally for each person,
right?
As you apply this text,
yeah,
yeah.
No, I'm moving from some of the salient points to how it's done, and the thing that I probably most appreciated about this entire sermon was owning the fright.
Mm.
Like, I've read this text a zillion times, I've preached on it at least once, and you oriented towards that last deal is like not fearing the frightening, mm. and I just thought that was perfect mm. to say, to kind of own the experiential state of what he knows he's saying. Mm. And I just was like, that's right. It's the reason it's an S word is because people abuse you when you submit,
yeah.
you know, they treat you poorly. And so it is scary.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a right instinct for freedom and there's a right instinct for submission.
Yeah.
And so you owning the scariness of it all.
And that's where that's where the Sarah piece is so valuable, but also very challenging.
Right.
Right. So, like, he offers her as this holy woman of old as an example of submission that yielded to her husband's words. And I think you can look at this in a positive way, right? Like, she left with him, all that she's known.
Right.
Worshiping the moon or whatever they were doing.
Oh, yeah. They had a pantheon for sure.
Yeah. And called to worship this one God mm-hmm. who's named Yahweh, who was revealed to Abraham alone.
Like, it imagine says we need
that.
To move,
like,
everybody.
Yeah, we're moving. And, you know, I thought about, like, you know, and I didn't say this in the sermon, but I thought personally, like, as, you know, my family's in Albuquerque, we're living a life, I'm pastoring a church, and Redeemer comes to me and says, hey, we want you to consider coming to Winston.
Right.
And I go and tell Danette, hey, and I've already talked about this with like other outside voices, right. Talked to my pastor's group. What do you guys think? Should I do this? And they're all, you should at least go through the process. I tell people to go through the process. And so I go to Danette and I'm like, okay, baby, I think we should go through this process. And she's like, hell no, we ain't doing that.
Right.
So in that moment, I can try to throw my weight around.
Right.
Or I can entrust this to the Lord and just say, okay, here's why I'm thinking this, mm-hmm. right? I am thinking that we should at least just see. Doesn't mean we have to do it.
Right.
In fact, what I told her is like, if we get through this process, they may not choose us, mm-hmm. and that'll be clear. If we get through this process, we'll take a trip to Winston together, and that will be nice. Even, you know,
right.
You know, whatever happens, like you get to see a new place, like that, if we get that far, that,
yeah.
that, and try to just like say, there's no demanding here. Mm-hmm. If you're not on board with this, we ain't going. And within a couple weeks, you know, she was entrusting herself to the Lord mm-hmm. in this, and her heart moved.
Right.
Right. So I think about this, like with Sarah, like, you know, she went with Abraham, and then I do believe he's talking directly about these two interactions with Abimelech and with in Egypt,
okay.
where Abraham doesn't trust God.
No.
And so he has Sarah lie about being his wife, and it puts her in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And yet God upheld her, protected her, right? Now that's, you know, really easy to read on the words on the page.
Yeah, especially after you saw, you know, the glorious ending. Yeah. right.
It's much harder when that's you, right? When you're when you're choosing to submit and your husband is making the wrong decision.
Right.
And what I tried to tease this out, because this was one of the questions that I got, you know, we didn't have a QR code. I apologize. We didn't have a QR code in the bulletin, even though I mentioned it in the first service, and I didn't in the second because I found out we didn't have a QR code. But one of the questions I did get from one of the women's Bible studies was that question, like, well, what does this look like? Like,
right.
when your husband is doing something that's, like, wrong, how do you submit? And are you supposed to submit? And we, you know, I tease this out a little bit more clearly in the second sermon than the first, but submission is not going along with your husband's sin.
Right.
Right. Not allowing. But Abraham wasn't necessarily sinning directly against Sarah. He was sinning against God by not trusting him. It had implications on Sarah. If he was sinning directly on Sarah, mm-hmm. I think that this might feel a little bit different. But because it was like a mistake, it was a sin.
Right.
And it had deep implications for Sarah. I'm not trying to take that away.
Right.
It was like out of fear for him and for her.
Yeah. Mostly for him, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you said, you kind of mentioned that. Yeah, yeah. What would they do to me?
Yeah.
But I do think she's in a, like, I went back and read and just to see, like, okay, so she's in an impossible situation either way, because they could kill him.
Yeah.
Like, her death options are on both sides.
Right.
And so, like, or her exploitation options are both sides of this.
Yep.
So she's not like choosing between sheer liberation and utter enslavery.
Right.
You know, her options, because of the patriarchy, frankly, mm-hmm. and the predecessors to what Roman rule would look like, mm-hmm. that she doesn't have great options here. Mm-hmm. And she's like, okay, this is a bad situation. I think he's making a bad decision, but let's go with this. And I want to know, like, when we see her in glory, I'm going to like, what was the calculus in your head in that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, how did you measure that out? Because I think it's super important.
Yep.
Because I hope I can say this. And well, I know I can say this, that if your submission requires you, when you know it's a foolish decision, requires you to put your life in jeopardy or your children's lives in jeopardy. In our context, mm-hmm. All of your pastors and all of your mm-hmm. elders will go, no,
yep.
do not.
That's right.
Do not submit to that.
Yep.
Again, her life was in jeopardy either way, mm-hmm. which totally stinks. But again, I don't want to also take away from the honor that Peter's trying to do in this to say, look at this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Who had a horrible lot to make decisions around, and she freely submitted to something that wasn't even necessarily great, and the Lord provided. So I don't want to undo that by explaining that other stuff. Yeah, I just think that it's just like, it's, I think it's just so weighty on all these sides. Yeah. And this is why we also need to collapse on Jesus to help us with these things. Because it's, and so just like you went to women in our church and other people, women in our church, I want you to talk with other women and pastors and others to just go like work it out. I mean, these are not always immediate decision making things. And so just like orient towards it. We had a woman in our church who is married to an unbeliever. And she came up to me afterward and said, "Will you guys just pray for me this week? Because this is heavy stuff. I know it. I've been working through this." And I was like, "I was praying for you. You were in my mind when he was preaching." Because I was like, "I know how this is hitting for her. And she's trying to orient towards this." And so I promised her we'd pray in our next meeting together for her. But
that's good.
But it's totally right. The other thing you did in concentration is this owning this right and this submission was the right adornment. It's so funny he uses adornment in the positive and the negative sense. You know what I mean? Like he's not saying adornment's wrong.
Right.
Yeah. He's not even saying beauty's wrong. He's not even saying any of that. It's just like, well, how are you orienting how you adorn your person, inner and outer? You were pretty strong on like concentrating on that.
I mean, I think in our moment, I wanted to really empathize, because I'm a man.
Right.
But I wanted to empathize with, if you do not have power and you know this is a way to achieve some level of power for yourself is through your beauty and your body, your sexuality, I wanted to like it own that reality. Like,
right.
Of course you would want to use that.
Right.
Right. Like that there is some place that you can have power to get what you need in a world that doesn't give you what you need or want, to use your beauty to get things done. Mm-hmm. And I do think the Lord understands that reality. Yeah. And I wanted them to hear that.
Right.
While at the same time, like, thinking that the text is calling them to, order themselves around inner beauty instead of that outer beauty, and even though it's tempting to use your sexuality, or your body or your beauty to get what you want, to try to not do that,
right?
And I do think Peter does have that in mind.
Yes,
yeah, I do think there's a lot of implications for this text based on the culture of the Greco-Roman world. If a woman is going to the house of worship and she's adorning herself and she's going by herself culturally, and if you think about just the cult prostitution of each of these different, areas, cities like where that would, and this is something that Paul is obsessed with for his churches. Like, we could talk about 1 Corinthians and why he asked for head coverings as just an example of this, because most likely the cult prostitutes shave their heads.
Right.
And so it could be misunderstood that this church was just another one practicing that sort of thing in their worship.
Correct.
And he is trying to distinguish between this church in Corinth and the cult prostitution that's happening in Corinth. So, like, it matters. So you walk out of your house and you're all decked out.
Right.
That could be misunderstood that this house of worship is just like
the cult practices the sexual cult practices. No, I think that's right.
And we didn't talk necessarily about that, but that is the implication, I think, in the text. And so why does Peter call them to considering their inner beauty? Like, it's a number of factors. Right. And I think that as you're a woman, that you exist and you have beauty of, every woman has beauty of different sorts.
Right.
You are beautiful.
Amen.
God has made you beautiful. Not just in your look, but just who you are as a person, and that you can use that in any sort of way to achieve, status for yourself and power. And our world feeds that.
Well,
our culture feeds that.
I think my favorite part of the sermon actually was when you were in the middle of talking about it and you just kind of stopped. And you said, ladies, I cannot believe how hard this is for you, yeah. or something akin to that. Yeah. And you just stopped a little bit and you were like both experiencing it and realizing it and trying to say it. That was my favorite pastoral moment of the whole place, of the whole sermon, because I was like, if they don't hear anything, they know their pastor understands that this kind of conversation is just really, really, really difficult. Mm. And you didn't bat an eye on how men, I think right after Reed says, and I've done it, and every man in here has done it, and which is a little leaning towards what's coming next. Mm. But I was like, yeah, there is a systematic reality of this in the hearts of people, and there are women who perpetrate it in a way towards other women. You know, you guys, you women tell me stories about how, you know, stories about how the boys got full breakfast in the morning, and you got a piece of toast, and it's just evil. That's just evil. Yeah. That's evil. 'Cause it's still worried about that outer beauty. But the inner beauty is that there's so much in there. I mean, it's called imperishable and precious.
Yeah.
I love the link that Jobs does on that, that this is the same stuff of the gospel. Yeah. It's like one of the most monumental statements in the first part of Peter.
Yep.
And then he realigns it.
Yeah, that was really cool.
It's just hot. That's just really amazing. Talk about adorning with beauty. Mm-hmm. You just got the found very precious as the very reality of Jesus's gospel and who we are in his eyes.
That gentle and quiet spirit that the God places in us as believers and in you, like this gentleness and this like meekness.
Yep.
You're restraining your outer beauty for this inner beauty to come out. Like that meekness is part of your inheritance because of your alignment with King Jesus. And that's beautiful.
Right. And that's that universalizing. So he's talking to women right now, but he's also, that's a universalizing because he just introduced those phrases earlier.
Yeah.
It's like in the Paul passage of Ephesians, it's like submit to one another. And then he lays out some other forms of submission underneath that. You know, it's just like, this is what we all do. This is the ethic. Ooh, that was another hotline from you. The something about a cruciform, the cross isn't a weapon. It is the like blueprint of the cruciform life. Like this is like a way of being. This is a universal Christian identity because of who Jesus is. And
it's not to be weaponized.
Not to be weaponized, right?
It's to be utilized in laying your life down.
Right.
Yeah.
And for, in this context, the hope that believers, that people would see Jesus.
Yeah. That's the thing about marriage, right? Like that marriage and its very thing is a moving picture, we're told, of the gospel. It's a moving picture of laying down one's life and loving. You're supposed to see the gospel lived out. It always has menstrual implications. And of course, we feel that. We fail at this. Christians' marriages aren't necessarily like, we have just as much struggles.
They're not necessarily exemplary of who Jesus is, but they're intended to be. That's the
And
purpose.
A lot of that comes out of most of us living in the wake of purity culture and what that's, how that's impacted us in our marriages. But it still is supposed to be missional.
Yep.
The ethical implications that gospel has a missional focus.
I always, in premarital counseling, if we're going through, if they're asking about Ephesians, I always tell them to outline the passage because Paul's like literally says, but I'm speaking about the church. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, you weren't. Yeah. The outline did not work. You know, you can't diagram that sentence that way. And you're like, oh, okay, this is back to the display of God's church. Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated by that. I was like, yeah, you would have gotten a C+ on that paragraph in regular grammar, but I get it now. You know, he's popping this image in the middle of a sentence that is just like, oh, okay. Well, I think the other thing is this out of the fright, the truly frightening realities, the trust.
Yeah.
And so for you, the great thing about Presbyterianism is that neither of our pastors are sovereign, not just because of our shared leadership model, but because we have elders, and elders are overseen by Presbytery and the General Assembly and, you know, all the kind of more hierarchical churches are, you don't have the last say. Mm-hmm. And you have to submit. Mm-hmm. And that's just within the authority structures. And yet we're all still called to submit even to people that we might lead, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that trust factor is super important. And I'd love for you to hear about that because, again, it's tough as a male pastor preaching a passage like this,
right.
where you're like trying to identify, but you also know you can't fully identify.
Yep.
Like next week's going to be so much easier for you because mm-hmm. you're like, dudes, I get this, you know? And so, those places where you feel the fright and then have kind of experienced like some deep trust.
Yeah. I mean, I think like that's why I read the two part of the passage included it in the reading of this text is because it's very much linked. We our exemplar is Jesus, and all the ways we fail to trust have been nailed to his body on the tree.
Yeah.
And I wanted to also say the frightening part of trusting the Lord. Like this is the walk, y'all. Like this is the daily battle.
Right.
Do we believe God to be good and for us? Do we trust that? How can we trust that? Well, we have to always come back to Jesus. Jesus is how we are to trust this. We're to bank on that hope and that. You know, it talks about Sarah. She hoped
right.
in something she could not see, which was the promise.
Right.
And yet we know that she did not always obey.
Right. She laughed.
She laughed. She got Hagar.
Yeah.
And like she tried to help the promise along. This is one of the reasons that her story is so
awesome.
Powerful and beautiful because you see the failings and yet she's considered this woman of faith.
Right.
This paragon, this exemplar, and yet she didn't do this perfectly. And so just to go like, man, we do get that part of like the trust piece because that's our struggle too.
Right.
Like we're not pastors just because we get this right and we always trust. I certainly don't, and I don't often in like relational dynamics with my own wife. I don't always trust.
Right.
I like try to fix and manipulate and get the things I want
right.
from her, and that's not a trusting way of being.
Not submission to the Lord. Yeah,
it's not a being a good partner to her.
Yeah.
So I think like at the end of the day, that is a call, and like. We are battling with this right now with the current dynamics, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this next week too. But like if our call, this is part of like we're trying to like, just so you all know, like you know we're working on a positive vision for our church, especially when it comes to like men and women,
yeah,
because of how we feel the threatening, the frightening in our own denomination,
yeah.
So we're called to submit. And so at what level does that impingement kind of push, go beyond the word of God
right.
and call us to something else?
Right.
And that's a wrestling that we're currently trying to figure out. But the positive vision of this is like, we are called to trust and trust ourselves to God.
Right.
And he has us as a church in this moment.
Where we are,
where
in our history. Yep.
And he will have us if there's a you know something else in the future,
right.
and we continue to come back to and bank and hope on that.
Yeah.
And it's a tough work.
It is.
Yeah,
it is. And I will say this that I'm thankful for in terms of our officers, just in conversations about all these things, is they're trying to take that responsibility. In the manner that Jesus took his responsibility to both lead and serve, you know, and I just want to brag on our folk for a little bit. That is not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
If you're right about something, then what you're supposed to do is win.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the posture of our groups that lead our church.
Yeah.
And it feels like holy ground that gives me great hope that we can figure this thing out together,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And even if we make a mistake, we'll make it together and then we'll adjust and repent or whatever it is. It's totally fine. So I'm very thankful. So you should be encouraged too.
You know, next week when we talk about, you know, verse 7, you know, that the term that's used by Peter is weaker vessels. And And my interpretation of that is not anything other than predominantly status. It's an understanding that throughout history, women have not been given equal co-heir status with men.
Right.
And even now, like as we live out our faith in this moment, that is still in jeopardy in some ways.
Absolutely.
And so how can we be men who honor the women in our purview,
mm-hmm.
whoever they are? How can we honor them by lifting up their status?
That's right. That's right.
Honoring them. And that is our heart here.
Yeah.
At Redeemer is like, we want within biblical purview, what's allowable according to the scriptures, what we think is allowable.
Yeah, as best as we can understand
and discern it. We want to honor you in your voices and your gifts. And who you are, who God's created you to be, to lift you up, because we understand that status is not always given to you as an equal and a co-heir.
Yeah, so, thanks for that preview. I'm super excited about that. Hopefully, we can talk a little bit more. You've touched on a couple times, but the honor shame realities, mm-hmm. and how honor is a commodity that only exists in X amount, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And so for you to honor someone else is to give up your honor.
Yep.
That no one would have thought differently, mm-hmm. that read any of these things early on. Like they did that, just, there was no, anyway. So to talk about that in terms of,
and that's scary.
That's scary. Cause it always feels like you're losing.
Yep.
And
you are
in some sense. Yeah. And the fact that he calls them, I'm already into next week. The fact that he calls them co-heirs is one of the most revolutionary things that has ever been written about women, mm-hmm. to men, mm-hmm. about making sure that happens. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all right, man, I appreciate it. Any other last thoughts?
No, man. It was like, I really appreciated having to like dig in. Like, several people asked me, hey, were you nervous about this? And I was like, one of the things when you feel pretty confident in like what you've studied in the Word, like it gives you a lot of freedom to like be shielded. Like I feel really confident that this is what was being said in this passage.
Right.
So I can come with like that confidence. I don't always feel that.
Right.
We don't always feel
there's
that.
There's lots of passages where you're like, I don't know if I get this one.
Yeah. So it took a lot of that away for me in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Well, and then, so this is when because usually when there's a tough text like this, I'm going in, like I am going to get my head and heart around, mm-hmm. this as best possible. And then the only anxiety I feel is, can I get that out?
Yeah.
Can it be heard? Yeah. Not even if I get it outright, but can do ears hear, you know? Yeah. And so that's what I was praying for you the whole time. I knew where your heart was going to be. I knew you'd done the work. But I was like, I was praying for our ears, and I was praying that all that work would get out. And I think you did a great job on that. I sense that from you, that like confidence. I get this. You can poke me in different places. It'll spill out, mm-hmm. but then you have 30 minutes, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And you're like, gosh, that's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. So, well, I'm thankful for you for doing that.
Yeah, man.
All right. Peace to you.
Yep. See you guys next time.